the Triathlon Show 291. Hey, what's up everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Björn Gesman. Björn is a Hamburg-based triathlon and endurance sports coach, and with a background from the German Sport University in Cologne. He coaches world-class athletes such as Patrick Lange and Katrina Matthews, to name just a couple. And he'll describe more of his background when we get into the interview, so I will save that for later. But before we get into that, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration. Precision Hydration creates electrolytes that you can match to your individual sweat sodium concentration. You can do that by going to precisionhydration.com and clicking the free hydration plan tab. And that is a simple questionnaire where you'll answer a few questions qualitatively. And Precision Hydration has created a database which allows them to get a really good estimate of how much sodium you lose in your sweat just based on how you answer those questions. And if you want to take it a step further, do scroll down to the bottom of the homepage on Precision Hydration. And there you'll find a link to book a free video consultation of 20 minutes to discuss the results of your online sweat test, and as well as your general hydration strategy and questions you might have for the experts in the Precision Hydration team. So take advantage of that great opportunity. Do tell them that you came from That Triathlon Show. And of course, we have a discount code if you want to buy Precision Hydration electrolytes. The code is That Triathlon Show 15, and it will give you 15% off your order. And thank you to Roka. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear and prescription glasses and sunglasses. Whether you're looking to go faster in the open water, get more performance and aerodynamics out of your trisuit, or find a perfect pair of eyeglasses that combines function, comfort and design, Roka have an option for you based on exceptional R&D and attention to every single detail in their product development and design. I use a ton of Roka products, from the Maverick X2 wetsuit to the Rory prescription glasses, and I can honestly say that I think all of them are really, really amazing products. I really like them all very, very much. You can get 20% off your entire Roka order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And a quick request that if you are a long-time listener and haven't yet rated and reviewed the podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever else you get your podcasts, please do that. It only takes a couple of minutes, but it really helps out because the podcast really needs to keep growing to be sustainable. So it's important to help new people find the podcast, and ratings and reviews really help with that. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Coach Björn Gesman. Today's guest on That Triathlon Show is Björn Gesman. Björn, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Oh, Michael, fine. I'm pretty fine. How are you?
I'm good as well. Thank you very much. Can you just start by introducing yourself to the listeners and telling us more about yourself and your background?
Thanks at first for having me. Pretty excited to be honest, have the first podcast in English. So I hope that I can handle it. And it's pretty interesting that I do not have to spell my name. So in international triathlon business, if I say that my name is Björn, it's pretty easy to tell it to a Swedish-speaking Finnish guy instead of talking to like people from UK or wherever, or USA, what I learned 2 weeks ago, that it's kind of difficult to spell that. So yeah, thanks for having me. I try my very best to introduce myself. So I more or less did like cycling, and more cycling than triathlon, as a child. Then went to the German Sports University in Cologne to study sports science. And I made my bachelor and master degree in sports science at the sports university. And it was pretty clear concerning the profession later that it needs to have to do with whether team sports or endurance sports. So maybe soccer, handball, whatever. That's what I played as a child, as I lived in a pretty small village where we did not have some kind of triathlon club or cycling club or whatever. And then I started working in cycling and triathlon more as a, I would say, like as an internship, as a trainee in about 2008, started doing performance diagnostics, more or less bike fittings, and then had my first athletes coached by myself in about like 2009, 2010, I would say. Then I finished university in 2012 and was, yeah, more or less working like 2 years before as a professional coach, but as a coach. And I started coaching cyclists and triathletes more on the age group level, and especially more cycling at the beginning. So I had a lot of clients or athletes participating, whether in semi-professional cycling or in all the stuff concerning ultra endurance cycling. So I had a lot to do concerning Race Across America and stuff like that. And since 2015, I have my own business concerning triathlon coaching and cycling coaching and all the stuff that has to do with performance testing and bike fittings and so on. So the company's name is High Size, and we are placed at three different places in Germany, so in Hamburg, Cologne, and Munich. And we are a team of like 15 sports scientists, more or less like five sports scientists per place. And our main profession is to, yeah, like coaching of triathletes and cyclists, a little bit runners, doing bike fittings, doing aerodynamic testings, doing performance diagnostics, and all this stuff which is more or less science-based and which you can do to make the athletes faster. And then I had all around like more or less always like 20, 30 age group athletes. Then I started doing professional athletes at about 2017, 2018. And then I decided on my own that I would just like to do the professional athletes and then just a handful. So that's the part I still do until today, that I got the coaching business on the one side and have my professional athletes on the other side. And it's always just about like more or less like 5 to 6 athletes, because yeah, main goal is always to coach everybody in the way you want to coach them, and therefore it depends on the quantity of athletes you have if you want to do it 100%, I would say. And yeah, that's where we stand today, more or less.
That's a great introduction. Can you just tell the listeners a few of the names of the professionals you coach, because you have some pretty big names on your roster?
So the first professional athlete, so real professional athlete, was Daniela Bleimel in 2018. And we won the challenge in Roth in a pretty spectacular finish. Maybe someone remembers the finish against Lucy Charles, where she beat her about like 8 seconds or 7 seconds or 9 seconds. I'm not sure. And then I started working with Boris Stein back in, what was it, like 17, 18? Honestly, I'm losing the countings of the years due to COVID. I do not remember whether we have like 2020 or 2021, because I'm missing the markers. Like that main competition in 2020 was when I supported whoever or coached whoever. So Boris Stein was the next one. And then I started working with Patrick Lange after his Kona finish in 19, or not finish in 19, let's say. So since 1.5 years. And since more or less half a year, I'm coaching Kat Matthews from UK. And yeah, I mean, these are the main names on the list, I would say.
Great. And let's go into coaching and discuss that a bit. So if you can just give an overview of your coaching and training philosophy, what would you describe it like?
Yeah, it's a good question, because to be honest, I never really made my own presentation about my coaching business and what I am doing. So it's some kind of making the experience that, on the one hand, scientific training is pretty important for me as a sports scientist. So that's why I studied 5 years of sports science at the German Sports University, because I liked, or I still like, the scientific part about training being proved by whatever metabolic testing, for example, you can have, or position adaptations being proved by the bike fitting baseline measurements, and then whatever you have when it comes to measuring techniques in bike fitting, whether it's like pressure mapping or video analysis and so on and so on. So therefore, the scientific part was pretty important. And when I studied it at the university, it was not really focused on endurance sports, but focused about the basic scientifics like physiology, biomechanics, anatomy, and so on and so on. And my purpose studying sports science was always to find a solution to get the transfer into practical training. So not only knowing about the scientific basics, but also make your own experience how to bring the science into the sports practice. And that's why I worked as a coach starting in, what I said, like 2010 ago, from that point on. And it was quite interesting, and that's what I still like about the whole coaching part, to have an idea for the athlete, which is based on his goals, his physiological profile, his by now psychological profile, his circumstances when it comes to training, and then to have your own idea. And yeah, I mean, maybe at least make your own plan, but I think that writing a training plan is one of the smallest jobs you do as a coach. And then to support the athlete on his way to his goal, and to have several parts in between where you can do some safety checks if you are on a good way, whether it's a competition, a performance diagnostics, where you can whatever check if the VO2 max after 3 months of training is arise by like 10% or whatever your goal is. And then I had that part first, doing training a lot of age group athletes, which is what I had to learn, completely different from coaching professional athletes, as you definitely have a higher distance in between you as a coach and the age group athlete. Because, I mean, yeah, we know it, that the coaching business consists of that you have to have like whatever 20, 30 athletes, otherwise it wouldn't make sense on a monetary part. And therefore, the distance in between you as the coach and the age group athlete is, I would say, kind of normal. Then I started working with professional athletes, which means not having contact like once a week, but once a day, which also means going into training camps, which also means supporting the races, which also means being way more personal than you would be maybe with an age group athlete, due to the whole holistically part of coaching, that it also is about personal belongings and so on and so on. And then I realized in about like 2019 that science-based training and all the physical stuff, let's summarize it, is maybe not enough to be a good coach. So it's good to study sports science to be a good sports scientist, but a good sports scientist is not equal to a good coach. And I was, to be honest, I thought that my soft skills and all my human intellect is good enough to support some athletes. And I made the experience about more or less like 10 years. But then I realized that in professional sports, I have to have some more, let's say, tools to coach the athlete, especially on the mental or psychological part. And that's why I did another education being a mental coach since like a year, more or less. And that really helped a lot at first to get to know myself better than before, and to realize what kind of person I am, and therefore what kind of coach I am. And also to get way more tools into the coaching process when it comes to how the situation and in which situation it is necessary to use this tool and that tool and this tool to do whatever you want with your athlete, whether it comes to bringing more confidence into the race preparation, bringing you know how the business works, more or less. So it's about coach the athlete in a good way and find solutions for different situations, especially on the psychological side also. And that really helped me a lot. So I would say that philosophy is about having the physical part and the psychological part. And then it's always scientific based. So it's always like a summary of all of it and also depending on the athlete. So sometimes it's more necessary to be the scientific coach, depending on your athlete or the situation. And sometimes it's more important to be like the, let's say, mental coach, friend, supporter, whatever, and having the sports scientist a little bit more in the back, for example. And yeah, that's what I would try to describe about the philosophy.
Yeah, I like that answer a lot. With the mental part, can you give perhaps one example of a tool or a strategy that you have used successfully from that toolbox, just to give an example?
So at first, it's mandatory to do a psychological test when we start the coaching. So that's what I do with every athlete to get a better overview about his personal psychological profile. And if I have that profile, I'm not doing it on first hand, because at first I really like a lot to have a talk to the athlete. So getting to know him better personally, maybe at first by phone when it comes to the distance due to, yeah, I mean, it's a global sport. So my athletes are based in Austria, UK, and Germany. But then after some talkings and after the first impression you have from your athlete, to do the psychological test. And that test tells you more about whether your athlete is more structured or not, or has a big, or let's say more or less personal belongings a lot or maybe less, and is more objective or more on the personal side when it comes to acting, whether it's in personal belongings or in a race, for example, depending on which situation you have. And if you know that profile, it's always, I mean, the solution for the coaching process is as individual as the training for the physiological profile also is. So therefore, it depends in the situation. Let's take a race situation. And if you do the race tactics, you sometimes have the athlete where you can say, be safe. This is your power output. You should not overdo for, let's say, if that is your threshold, you know that you can do it for like 6 minutes. If you have to go for 6 minutes, go ahead. If it's more like 6 minutes, maybe drop that group and concentrate yourself on getting into the next group or whatever. And giving him more like a structured plan where he knows about pace in running, power output in cycling, nutrition stuff, and so on. On the other hand, you have athletes which are more on the personal part, where it comes in race tactic, where it's important not to talk about data or numbers, but to give him the opportunity to go like, go for 50Ks full gas on the bike and see how it goes. And then you can start having a structured plan. But at first, have fun. So, and have fun destroying other groups, getting back to group number one after bad swim or whatever situation you have in race tactics. And you do not only have this situation with race tactics, but also in personal life, whether it comes to whatever you have, to the normal relationships you have in your private life, or relationships to your coach, the talkings you have with him. And then it always comes to, I mean, the wordings you use, the situations you describe. Then it comes to strategies like visualization of different situations in training, in the race, what you want to achieve, goal settings, and so on. All that stuff depends on your psychological profile and the way you want to bring that idea to your athlete. So that's more or less the plan I use for them.
Yeah, no, that is great. That is really good. And This reminds me of a conversation, an interesting conversation I had a while ago with somebody, and I think you are somebody who might be in a good position to give your opinion on it. And that is, do you think that on average there is a difference on the mental side, on the psychological side, between professional athletes and amateur athletes?
You mean from the mental setting?
Yeah, it could be like, I mean, I don't want to talk about mental strength here necessarily, but whether they have a different profile or like some generalities if you look at a population level.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because we discussed that when I did my education about the mental coach part. I was the only coach, let's say, who was working in endurance sports. The other coaches, they were like a group of 10 people doing that education, then, and they came from totally different backgrounds. So some of them were psychological students and wanted to do the mental coach education. Others were coachings in whatever, tennis or I don't know. And we discussed whether at first you have to have some parts in your psychological profile which bring you to triathlon and not to, for example, like team sports or whatever, which definitely is a yes. I would say that triathletes are way more structured normally than a team player is. So just average. So not in, I wouldn't say that overall, but if you take the average, I would bet that you have to be a little bit more structured to bring like 35 hours of training per week into your normal rhythm of a week. And, but when it comes to professional athletes and age group athletes, to be honest, I'm not sure. So I wouldn't say that a professional athlete always has the habit to be very with or who has a very high mental strength, for example. You'll also find professional athletes who don't have that or who have to get that potential to being to be strange in your mental habits, for example. And on the other side, I mean, if you take the age group athletes by now, it's not like a group of people just having fun out there, but also a group of people who are very consistent in training, who bring in a lot of knowledge, which they read on different, whatever, newspapers, maybe slightly scientific literature or whatever, and have way more knowledge, I would say, than a normal amateur athlete in soccer, for example. And therefore, I would say there's a difference in average between triathlon and, for example, team sports. But I would not say that there is definitely a difference between professional triathletes and age group triathletes, because I think you'll also find a lot of very mentally strength age group athletes out there. If you have to perform on an Ironman distance, you have to have some kind of mental strength. Otherwise, I think it wouldn't work out to bring that one home, as you always in every competition of that duration, you have like phases where it's not running perfect and you're not into the flow and you're struggling with your mental performance at that moment, maybe. So therefore, a little bit of mental strength is, I would say, like essential for an age group triathlete.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, let's go a bit deeper into each of the disciplines of triathlon and discuss your views around training for each of them. So perhaps if you can just give a couple of pieces of advice for what you think are important with the training in each disciplines and maybe some practical tips. So if we start with swim training, what are some cornerstones of that for you?
I think that when it comes to swim training, I would say that the most important key is consistency in training. So if you want to have the feeling of water and if you want to feel good in the water, then as a professional triathlete, you have to train minimum like 4 times a week in average throughout the year, excluding off season. So 5 times is better. If 6 times is necessary, depends on your capability of swimming, I would say. And if you have that consistency, I would say that, like, let me put it in numbers more or less, like 70 to 80% of your swim training is fine when you just have the consistency of swimming like what you have, like 20Ks per week, for example. If you have that kind of kilometers in the back, then I would recommend to not do too much technique training. So that's especially what I see in age group athletes, that they know a lot of technique drills, way more than I could ever know. But if you just do them on your own without the supervision of a coach standing on the side, then I'm not sure if you're doing it right. And sometimes, due to all that technique stuff, in my opinion, the athletes lose a little bit of overview about also physiology in swimming. So for sure, the technical part in swimming is way more important than it could be in any other discipline due to density of water, which is like way higher than, for example, of air. Therefore, you do not really have to care about aerodynamics in running for sure, but you have to care about technique and the density of water or hydrodynamics in swimming. And therefore, it is important, but I think sometimes the athletes lose the focus on also physiological training, which means find the differentiation between the intensities. Go for more kilometers, more duration with less intensity, but also have parts where you have like high intensity of more than like 20 seconds. So not only like 15 meters, but also like 50 meters or 100 meters or 200 meters, maybe 400 meters of higher intensity. And what is important, in my opinion, to find a differentiation in between. So if you look at the swimmers in the pool, then sometimes warm up is way more intensive than it should be when it comes to just slightly endurance warm up. So if you have the chance as a coach to measure lactate values after the warm up, then you're going to be shocked more or less to see that sometimes warm up is at whatever 4, 5, 6 millimol per liter of lactate. Which you would never ever do in running or cycling, never ever. So therefore, I would say find a differentiation in between the intensities. If it's about high duration and less intensity, do it with less intensity and not only with like some kind of mid-intensity somewhere between endurance training zones and more or less high-intensive training zones. Do not do too much technique drills and always look on the efficiency for your workout. I mean, you have an hour of time, maybe like 1.5 hours. And if you swim like 2,500 meters in 1.5 hours, it's not enough. So, I mean, that's not really efficient to stop after every technique drill, have a talk on the side, look on the paper again, have some whatever, drink some water. I mean, it's good to have that, but always keep in mind that you have to get the job done in training, and you have to do like, I mean, if we talk about professional athletes, more or less like 4Ks per hour should be something, or like doesn't have to be an hour, but like an hour and 10 minutes should be something you have to get done due to that the kilometers count. It's more or less the same principle than in running. I mean, you can be a track and field athlete and do training of an hour and have like 500 meters in your training session for an hour. That makes sense for sprinters or 200 meter runners or 400 meter runners, but not for triathletes when it comes to running. So therefore, I would say swim kilometers count, same as running kilometers count. And then it depends on the quality. So technique, yes, but not too much. Intensities, yes, but differentiated. In between lower training intensities, mid, higher training intensities, and so on.
That's a great overview. If you have a professional athlete that's swimming, let's say 5 times per week, how often would they do a proper kind of intense set? Would it be maybe a couple of times per week, or and the rest would be more endurance focused, or how would you distribute that?
So let's take into account that the other disciplines are, let's say, average. So I'm always a big fan to have the overview when it comes to stress management and so on, compared in between the disciplines of swimming, cycling, and running, and also strength and conditioning, athletic training, whatever you have. Therefore, if the other part of running and cycling has not really a main focus on its disciplines, but is just more like average, I would say that it's not a big problem to have one or two workouts per week, which have the label of intensity. But that will be the same principle also for cycling and running. I'm not a big fan of high intensity. For sure, in swimming, intensity means mostly way more intensity than you have in cycling and running. But if I talk about one or two sessions being intensive, that would normally mean like that it doesn't have to be like high intensive training, but like, let's say, whatever, 5x400 meters threshold training, for example. And then you can do some critical swim speed tests before to know where your 400 meters time is. And you take like, whatever, 10% off to have your threshold. And then you do it like 5x or whatever. And therefore, I would say like 1 to 3x, depending on the other sessions. But you should also have like 1 or 2 sessions which really are, which really consist of a bit more kilometers in duration. And have like, let's say 4 to 5 Ks within the workout. And then, I mean, again, it's about the quality. You do not have to have too much technique drills if there's not a coach at the site who's doing some kind of corrective job for you and telling you about the times or telling you about your technique and so on. So therefore, I would also depend that. So the program of the training, not only about intensity, yes or no, or duration, yes or no, but also about if you have a coach on your side who's helping you out, who's doing the correction and so on and so on.
Hmm. If you're an age grouper and you can swim 3x per week, for example, what would you say that they should do with those 3x per week?
Get yourself a good swim group.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's what I really, so when it comes to swimming, I mean, it's some kind of monotonous sport. It's not like going out cycling, seeing a great landscape or whatever. So therefore, I would recommend to think about the opportunity to get some kind of swim group. And if you have that swim group for at least 1 or 2x per week, then again, consistency is safe. So if you go to that swim group, which makes it way easier to motivate yourself to go swimming, if you know that your swim group is swimming at like, let's say, 6 p.m. on Tuesday and Thursday, then you can be sure that you're going to make it to swim training. Otherwise, you have to have a lot of internal motivation or intrinsic motivation to go swimming alone, on your own, stopping your times on your own, deciding maybe on your own. I mean, for sure, your coach can give you some technique drills, but you can never supervise if your athlete really is doing it. And when it comes to motivation, he has to do it all on his own. So no chance to have some kind of corrections or whatever. So therefore, I would highly recommend to get a swim group, and you do not have to care if it's a group of triathletes or swimmers. It's just about that the performance level should be some kind of same to your own. So you shouldn't be always the last one finishing the drills, for sure. But if you have that and you can do technique drills in a group with a coach on the side, like 2x a week, that would be a great solution. And then you can have the other session from the three ones to do your own training, maybe less intensity, as group workouts are mostly a little bit more intensive, which makes sense due to motivation yourself, or motivate yourself to higher intensity is easier to do it in a group than on your own. And then to have the third session, like a session with more duration, maybe on the weekend, maybe you can do like open water swimming on your own, for example, which is very important in my opinion to get the transfer from pool to open water, swimming in wetsuit and not only in normal swim shorts or whatever. And that would be your third session. And therefore, otherwise, if you have to do it on your own, I would say three sessions should be one intensive one more or less, depending, mid-intensity, depending on what other stuff you do in cycling and running, and then one workout which is more based on a higher duration.
Great. Let's move on to bike training then, if you can give a similar description of what you believe are the important pillars of bike training.
I'm a big fan of all that stuff which is like power meters and so on, because cycling is more or less the only discipline overall, in whether it comes to endurance sports or whatever sport you have, where it is possible to directly measure your performance output. So you do not have that in swimming. In running, we have opportunities where power output is calculated by now, but not measured. That's a big difference. And therefore, I'm a big fan of a power meter. And what you have to have, in my opinion, is that you know more or less perfectly how to use your power meter for physiological training, as it gives you the opportunity to really train 100% efficient. On the other hand, especially when it comes to triathlon, it's very important to have some kind of cycling skills, as the time you gain when it comes to perfect aerodynamic setup is nothing against the time you lose when you cannot do the corner correctly, or when you are not able to accelerate in a solid way, or whatever you have in a race, for example. Therefore, I would find maybe a solution where you have, let's say, physiological training. Same procedure with indoor training. I mean, it's a great opportunity to train indoor, and all that stuff when it comes to Zwift and so on is something which is a big benefit you have in triathlon. But on the other hand, you shouldn't lose your cycling skills. Therefore, there has to be a workout where you get up on your road bike, or also maybe on your mountain bike, your gravel bike, whatever you can have, and maybe have a workout where you ride in the group, where you have intensities which are not 100% planned, but where you just have a group of people where you go out for 3 hours and, yeah, you just see how it goes. Sometimes it's way more intensive than you expected. Sometimes it has to be of low intensity, but it's cooler to stay in a group and do like 5 hours or 4 hours of workout and so on. Take Patrick as an example. One of the first things I did when he moved to Salzburg in Austria, I know some cyclists living in Salzburg, like Gregor Mühlberger, who was riding for Bora Hansgrohe and is now riding for Movistar. And he has a bunch of cyclists living around the area of Salzburg. And the first thing we did was to connect him just to see how a real cyclist, so a pro cyclist with a lot of talent, is sitting on his bike, doing the corners and so on, and is working with his bike. And that helped a lot when it comes to technique and so on. So therefore, power meter is great, physiological training, indoor training, whatever you can have, all that stuff, really, really great. But do not lose your cycling skills, or if you do not have them, as you're a rookie, for example, no problem, then try to get them with some sort of, yeah, like I said, whether you take your TT bike or road bike or gravel bike, doesn't matter, but go out on your, find a cool training route where it goes uphill and downhill. And if you can't keep your training zones while going downhill, then don't hesitate with that. Just try to make the best out of the corners, or try to find a good solution where you can pace your power output also when there's a slightly decline, for example, which I hear very often, that it's not possible to have the ergometer modus outside. So, and that's what I say, that therefore you have like brakes and shifters. That's what you have to use outside to still ride in endurance training zones, even if it's slightly uphill or whatever, and that you can still ride a threshold interval also when it not goes uphill. And you can also ride it in the flat parts, for example. And that's what you have to learn, whether it comes to shifting, a technique, corners, braking, and so on. So all that stuff which belongs to cycling skills.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I think it's probably a first on this podcast that we've really heard it discussed in such detail with the importance of the cycling skills for triathletes. Yeah, I think it's important that you bring it up. When it comes to the physiological side that you mentioned there at the start, with the importance of being specific to your own physiology, can you describe that a little bit more? What sort of testing would you like to do with your athletes, and how does that then determine what specific kind of training they would be doing?
Yes, let's get a little bit into physiology at that point. Cycling is a very easy discipline, to say that, and you see me smiling. So it's meant a little bit ironical, but on the physiological side, it's pretty easy. I mean, there are two physiological parameters that count when it comes to cycling. That's on the one hand, your anaerobic metabolism, which is the one that decides about how much lactate production you have, whether it comes to training or racing, let's say at different intensities. And on the other hand, it's your aerobic metabolism, which is important for getting rid of lactate, but also to produce power out of all that stuff which belongs to oxygen uptake. So if you take the normal possibilities to generate power output, then you have like three different options. On the one hand, you have like anaerobic and alactic metabolism, which is not important for triathlon, as triathlon always has to do with a duration longer than a 100-meter sprint, for example. So therefore, you can get rid of that one. And on the other hand, you just have these two ways of producing energy or power output. So anaerobic and aerobic. And if you take into account that, let's take the FTP or the anaerobic threshold, which is more or less the most important parameter which describes your performance or your level of performance. And your anaerobic threshold, if you take that physiologically, is the highest power output you can have, where your metabolism of lactate production and elimination is still leveling. So production is as high as elimination is. So therefore, your lactate value you have when you would take blood from your earlobe would be stable at that power output for some time, let's say. So not for like 3 hours for sure, but as the FTP, let's take that one, is about an hour. And therefore, the lactate value should be more or less stable, let's say, to make it easy. And when it comes to anaerobic and aerobic, I mean, to lactate production and lactate elimination, the principle for triathlon is pretty easy. You don't want to have anaerobic metabolism high, as anaerobic metabolism means that you produce lactate, which means that you have to put carbohydrates in there. And as carbohydrates are your main fuel for that performance, and that one which is highly limited, as your storages, your personal storages in your body are not pretty high, especially compared to your fat storages, you have to have that one as low as possible. When it comes to aerobic metabolism, principle is 180 degrees around. So the higher your VO2 max, which is the marker for aerobic metabolism, the higher your VO2 max is, the more power output you can produce depending on your oxygen uptake. So therefore, best combination would be to have low lactate production rate, or a low lactate production rate, and a very high VO2 max. And then it's kind of easy. You just have to see or check the physiological profile of your athlete and see whether he has a low, mid, or high lactate production rate. Same procedure for the VO2 max, whether it is low, mid, or high, or something in between. And then you can decide, depending on the goals the athlete has and the time you have for training, as both metabolisms need some different time to adapt, which parameter you want to have first, if you want to have both parallel getting trained or whatever, depending on, like where you want to have these parameters for the next competition and so on and so on. And, or especially when it comes to coaching, not only from October to main competition in June, but also when it comes to coaching your athlete 2 years, 3 years, 4 years in a row, and to make a plan where you want to have your athlete. And if your athlete has the potential to adapt to wherever you want to have him. So is it possible that your athlete can have a very, very low anaerobic metabolism? And is it possible that he achieves values of, like, let's say 80 milliliters or more when it comes to VO2 max values? Yeah, and then, I mean, cycling is easy. Like I said, then you just have to decide which sort of training you put into depending on the individual physiological profile. And especially in triathlon, it's pretty easy as the, and for sure also in professional triathlon, but also on the age group level, that a high amount of training hours per week means that you normally have a pretty low rate of lactate production. So therefore, normally you can say that that one is already okay, maybe already good, maybe already perfect. And depending on that one, you can decide to how much input you want to have to hire your VO2 max. And then you can decide, do you try to hire the VO2 max with like more duration training? Is it like, do you want to bring in threshold training when it comes to intensities? Or do you need some high intensity training because maybe we have an age group athlete who is only able to have, like, let's say 6 hours of bike training per week, and then just low intensity, high duration training is not enough to make him, to bring him to a different or to a higher performance level. So therefore, I would say highly dependent on physiological profile. And then it's just about how you get the transfer into training, how many hours you have, and what about the overall training compared to the other disciplines.
Yeah, that's a great overview. And I was going to ask you whether you, in pros in particular, whether you see that it's more normal to see that, well, the VO2 max is the one you want to work on, or the VLA max. It sounds a bit like, at least if you're talking about pros that have been doing triathlon consistently for some time, that it's maybe the VO2 max, because the VLA max is quite often already at least okay.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you are a professional triathlete, then you are doing that sport for at least minimum, I would say, like 5-6 years. If not, then you have had a different profession before, as you were, whatever, a marathon runner, a pro cyclist, or a pro swimmer, or whatever. So all that comes together with a lot of hours of training, and a lot of hours of training always means that your body is kind of clever to adapt, that he knows that if he has to train for 20, 25, 30 hours per week, and he has two possible energy sources, and the one are carbohydrates, which are highly limited, and the other ones are your fat stores, then even the body, which is normally not really clever, let's say, so if you give him a gel, for example, he takes the gel first instead of taking the fat stores, so not really clever, to be honest. But in that case, he learns how to deal with it, especially, I mean, the basics for that are all that stuff when it comes to your muscle structure, which type of muscle fibers you use. And if you are, for example, a passionate marathon runner, then you have to do it on your slow endurance fibers and not on your fast fibers, which lead you to a fast 100-meter sprint. And if you are, depending on whatever you did before, you did that with a certain amount of training, otherwise you couldn't be a professional triathlete. And every time it comes to also endurance in training, so several hours of training, then you have to use your type 1 fibers and the fibers which are based on all your oxygen uptake, for example, and not the fibers which use mainly carbohydrates or even lactate as the basic energy fuel. And therefore, the VLA max is normally pretty low, which does not mean that you can take that as a safe parameter. So you cannot say that VLA max is low, and therefore we cut off like 10 hours of bike training per week and just go for, let's say, 8 hours per week and do it all in a high intensity way. Because in my opinion, you have to have certain amount or hours amount of training in your normal bike training, same procedure for running. You cannot only say that VLMX is fine, running economy good, and then you have to hire your VO2 max with just two track sessions in a week. That doesn't work out. So you always have to have a certain amount of minimum training per week, which leads you to a secure VLMX, for example, which is also beneficial for your VO2 max. And then you can decide whether you want to put ahead the last percentages of, let's say, intensity in training, for example, to hire the VO2 max from, to say some numbers, from 70 to 75 milliliters, for example, in VO2 max. And in that case, I think intensity is some kind of necessary to have that in your training, as just low intensity training doesn't make sense. I think maybe in cycling 30 years ago, you were a good pro cyclist if you just had low intensity training. But by now, every professional athlete, whether it comes to cycling and triathlon, is aware that he has to bring some intensities into training to bring his VO2 max on a level where you can say that it that is not only based on like low intensity training, but that you also put some input into your physiology due to or with intensities, which highs your VO2 max and brings it on a certain level where you want to have that.
Mm. And you talked about, of course, you can maybe do some really high intensities above threshold, but you also mentioned that in some cases, maybe you're using threshold intensity, even though the focus might be VO2 max. Can you explain that a little bit more? Is that the case that you don't always have to go and do those typical VO2 max workouts?
Yeah. So when you want to train your VO2 max, oxygen uptake and the amount of oxygen uptake, let's say per minute, per hour, per training week, per training block, whatever you have, is important. The more you have, the better. So, and your body adapts due to the impact you give him when it comes to the rate of metabolic or oxygen uptake, and therefore to adapt the metabolism to learn that mitochondria, biogenesis, and so on is working better than before, let's say, to make it easy. And what you put into is not the first question. At first, it's the amount of, so therefore you have to have some duration. And 10 hours of training is double the duration of 5 hours training, therefore double the amount of oxygen uptake you have, which makes sense. Therefore, you are not able to cut off the hours in training and put high intensity into, because if you just do it easy and calculate on your own how much more oxygen you can uptake due to the intensity, then you always have to keep in mind that especially when it comes to high intensity, it's not really a big amount of training. So if you do, for example, like, let's say we do a high intensity workout where you have like 30 seconds of 130% of your threshold, or let's say at 100% of your VO2 max, which is really intensive, and you do it 30 seconds, then 30 seconds a break, and then you repeat that like 8 times, 10 times, which is a great session in my opinion for every cyclist, which can also be a great session for every age group athlete, which just a limited number of hours of bike training per week. But if you take into account that we just talk about 30 seconds and maybe like 10 times in a row, then we have like 300 seconds of high intensity. And if you calculate how many oxygen uptake that means, it's not as big as it feels when you do like 10 times the 30 seconds, for example. For sure, you have some beneficial side effects when it comes to all your cardiopulmonary system, for example, which totally makes sense. But the problem I see when it comes to high intensity training is that compared to the normal other training you have on your bike and also compared to the other disciplines, you always have to have in mind the whole stress management for your athlete as a coach. And for me, it makes way more sense to have intensities which are A1 level, A2 level, so like which is normal endurance level, like 60, 70, 80% of your threshold, and then threshold level, so 100% of your FTP, maybe slightly above, like 105, 110%. And if you take that intensity, you have the benefit that you are not really talking about bringing your anaerobic system into running at a high level, because at threshold level, for sure, you produce a little bit of lactate, but not really like a lot. And it's not really like having the problem about whatever pH values not being balanced and so on when it comes to too much lactate in your muscular or maybe also in the blood, but muscular first. And therefore, I'm a big fan to put in a certain amount of intensities, especially of threshold intensities. But I think due to the, especially in professional triathlon, I'm not sure if there was a high intensity session for Kat, Boris and Patrick within the last 6 months of training. So I'm, to be honest, pretty sure they didn't do any interval session where they were higher than threshold. So threshold, a lot. I would say in average, like every second or third workout, no matter if it's swimming, running, or cycling, includes threshold intensities. And also intensities like whatever, 4 times 8 minutes threshold. And if you, again, put on the calculation and think for yourself about what it means to have like 32 minutes of threshold intervals, and if you calculate the oxygen uptake you have for that 3-hour session, then I'm pretty sure that on the one hand, for sure, you can have a higher oxygen uptake with high intensity, but the question always is how the athlete feels after that session and how many stress that was for him. Because if you do a normal threshold session, whether it comes to cycling or running, and if we take like, let's go to running. If you go for 3 times 1,000 meters or 4 times 5 times, then for sure that session is intensive. And for sure, you have to put a lot of effort in it. But if you have to go for a 3-hour easy bike ride after it, yeah, no problem at all. So, but if you have a very high intensity session on the track, for example, then the question is always if you can still keep the quality for your bike ride after it, and if it's maybe not too much stress for the whole system, and if you are, as a coach, still able to handle that stress, because that's your job to do that. It's not the job of the athlete to do that, but it's your job to do that. And this is something where I'm totally safe when it comes to threshold intervals and all the intensities you have until that intensity. But where I would never, ever, in a normal training block, let's say, put high intensity sessions in, as I would not be safe when it comes to the stress management. I would not be sure if I can write down 30 hours in a training plan and add like 3, 4, 5 high intensity sessions into it, and if the athlete is able to do that and to handle that stress.
Yeah, well, this is very interesting, and it's I would say it's a great example of applying sports science knowledge, but something that you can't directly find necessarily in a study, because we have hundreds of studies about the effectiveness of high intensity interval training. And here comes you with a sports science background, and you're saying that, well, somebody like Patrick or Kat hasn't done high intensity training in 6 months, basically. But I think it's just fantastic how you look at it from the overall level of how much oxygen uptake you have on a weekly level and a monthly level and so on. And I guess on the bike, you could just directly measure it with kilojoules almost. How can you maximize the amount of kilojoules you put in?
Perfect. That's why you have a power meter. Yeah. And that's 100% with you. That's a great parameter to measure also stress. I mean, when it comes to the normal parameters you would use normally for stress, and you take like simple one, the training stress score, for example, then my words are always that the training stress score is something which calculates several numbers, but which does not take into account whether you do your workout in the morning with or without breakfast. Did you have carbohydrates before, or did you not have carbohydrates before? Did you have an intensive session on the day before where your carbohydrate stores are maybe slightly depleted? Or are you doing that session 100% recovered with two rest days before? And therefore, the training stress score is something which is a bit helpful, but shouldn't be a parameter, in my opinion, as a coach, especially not in professional sports, because the amount of training you have and the differences in how you start that training session, so good sleep, bad sleep, carbohydrates, yes or no. If we talk about women's sports, are you into your cyclist by now, and in which phase are you at, which makes a big difference when it comes to training. And same procedure for energy stores. Are you in the third week in a row where you had like 30 hours of training, or is it your third session after a week of resting and recovery, for example? Training stress score, always the same depending on power output, but stress for the athlete, way different. And therefore, in my opinion, like you said, kilojoule, for example, the energy expenditure you have is a good solution to also track the stress for the athlete. Because, I mean, it's a pretty direct parameter when it comes to tracking also the oxygen uptake. I mean, take into account that oxygen uptake is 100% linear until threshold, let's say, with your power output. And power output is, in cycling, 100% linear, more or less, to your energy expenditure, because you can do nothing wrong in cycling. So you have to turn that crank by 360 degrees, and best case, like like 90 times per minute. But the position is fixed. Your feet are fixed in the shoes. Your shoes are fixed on the pedal. Your butt is fixed on the saddle, and so on. So therefore, the efficiency is the same principle all that time. So, and if you then take the energy expenditure, power output, whatever, then oxygen uptake and energy expenditure are, let's say, slightly similar. For sure, not 100%. And if you add like high intensity, that doesn't work out anymore. But for, I would say, like 96%, to say some kind of number to make it a bit clearer, 96% of your training volume and so on is describable with energy expenditure, and it works out pretty well. What you cannot do in cycling for sure is to describe training with, for example, kilometers. But if you take swimming or running, then in running, for example, you are not able to have like junk miles where you run like 8Ks without having a lot of, or the normal energy expenditure you have while running A1 endurance training zone, for example. In cycling, yeah, for sure, you can have like whatever, tailwind and going slightly downhill, and then you're riding like 8Ks without any amount of energy expenditure. Or if you're riding on the TT bike, for sure, you can do like 4 kilometers more per hour without putting any more power output into. So therefore, kilometers do not count in training. Don't, I mean, yeah, you can for sure write them down, or you can track them or whatever, but they are not really helpful. Same procedure for hours. If you cannot be safe that you just have an amount of, let's say, like 10% of junk miles, which means for me that you are lower than training zone A1, so like whatever, 60, 65, 70% of your threshold. And if you are lower due to normal traffic situations, fair enough, no problem. But if you are lower because you cannot continuously pace your training, then it's your problem and you're doing junk miles and not having a high efficiency in training. So therefore, it's up to you to make it better. And energy expenditure is way better in cycling than kilometers or hour could ever be.
Got it. And one more follow-up question on this cycling topic, going back to VO2 max and VLA max. So we mentioned, we talked about the professional triathlete situation, but what about age groupers? Let's say that it's still somebody who has at least 2 or 3 years of experience in triathlon, so not a complete beginner. But is it more common, do you think, in age groupers that that they might actually have to do some specific work for VLA max, that it might be not that good from the start because they have lower training volume and so on?
A perfect question, and I think we could make a podcast just for that question, to be honest, because that's the experience I made. I mean, you don't go into coaching business without any experience, and I'm a good coach. You have to do that experience, and my experience in doing high-intensity training, for example, it's not that I've never done that before. I did it quite often, to be honest, and if you would ask my cyclists within the last 10 years, which I trained, then they would, I don't know, maybe laugh about me saying that high intensity is not included into training, because they made a very different experience when it comes to the cyclist. When it comes to age group triathletes, I would say it depends a little bit on the background you have, and then especially on the amount of training you can do per week. And what I mean with you can do per week is not about how many hours of free time you have, but how many hours of training you can give your body and still be sure that he can adapt it and he still can recover well. So if you start as a rookie and have a half-time job, I mean, just on a white paper, yeah, for sure, you can do like 15 hours of training, but from 0 to 15 hours would bring definitely a lot of problems to your body, whether it comes to passive structure or whatever, which won't lead you to a continuous training for the next months in a row. And therefore, I would say that if you have an athlete with experiences for, let's say, 2-3 years, like you said, he's done some mid-distances, his background, wherever that was, whether he was an amateur soccer player, basketball player, he did no sports at all or whatever. And what normally happens, the less sport you do or the more, let's say, high-intensive sports you do, the more type 2 fibers you have in your muscles. The older you get, the more these type fibers switch to the 1 fibers. Women have more type 1 fibers than men normally. And if you do like 2-3 years of continuous training, let's say like, let's start at the bottom. So like 4 to 8 hours per week, which is, in my opinion, definitely enough to have a pretty good development, for example, for an Olympic distance or something like that. If you want to do a mid distance, maybe I would say that 6 to 8 hours can be enough to do a pretty good mid distance if you have enough quality in training. So, and when we come then again to VLA max and VO2 max, on the one side, I would say that it is possible to add a high intensity session, whether it comes to running or cycling, into your training when you train for like 6 to 8, 6 to 10 hours, whatever. And if due to the lower amount of training, I would also see it as essential to add some kind of input in training which will lower your lactate production rate. Let's make an example. You have to have a workout in a normal week where you start training without carbohydrates in the morning. So to be more concrete, the Saturday workout in the morning, let's say like 2 hours bike ride, or if you do it on the indoor trainers, like 1 hour, 1.5 hour. And that should be something where you have a good solution. So we talk about a normal worker, so a normal employee or whatever who has free time on Saturday and Sunday and therefore has the possibility to train in the morning without breakfast or without carbohydrates. And therefore, that session should be something where you do not have carbohydrates before. If you do not have carbohydrates, your anaerobic metabolism is running slightly, let's say, slower or not that intensive, because the macronutrient you have to have for that metabolism is missing. And therefore, your body is forced to bring some more energy out of fats, and especially your own ones, to generate the power output you have to have for that training session. So, and that is a session I would say you have to have as an age group athlete. And now you can adapt it to, it doesn't matter if it's like the Saturday morning training without carbohydrates on the bike or on the run. For sure, you can also go running 2 times a week in the morning without having carbohydrates for breakfast, for example. Lactate production rate is normally slightly lower in running than in cycling, especially due to not having the possibility to do junk miles. So therefore, you have to have a higher amount of volume normally. And therefore, I would maybe slightly recommend to do it, especially for the bike part. But all that stuff when it comes to periodization of carbohydrates, which I think is something that has to be in at some point in every training plan for an age group athlete, is also possible not only with, let's say, having non-carbohydrates for breakfast on Saturday, but you can also have carbohydrates on Saturday morning for breakfast and then have a 3-hour bike ride, put some threshold intervals in between, and then maybe have a run after it. It doesn't have to be a brick session or a transition or whatever, but maybe having just a slightly amount of carbohydrates after the bike part and then doing a run in the afternoon with low intensity, maybe a slightly higher volume. And you can be sure that after that bike ride of 3 hours with intensity, that your carbohydrate stores are not at 100%. So therefore, you can have the same effect whether it comes to periodization of the normal nutrition, for sure. But on the other hand, you can also have slightly the same effect due to the training you put into and the carbohydrates you expend while training, and especially while training at high intensity. So that depends on your structure. Let's just a short example for pro triathlon. You don't necessarily have to cut off carbohydrates from the normal nutrition, as the training amount per week is that high that the carbohydrate stores are definitely 100%, not 100% filled for every session. So therefore, if you go 1.5 hours swimming in the morning for 4.5Ks and you have a little breakfast after it, then your carbohydrate store is not 100% filled. And if you go for a 4-hour bike ride, the carbohydrates are there for the first 1-2 hours, but then you do a lot of fat metabolism training as the carbohydrate stores are slightly depleted, and therefore you force the body to use the fats, for example.
Right, yeah. And then finally, let's talk about the run a little bit. So again, give an overview and some tips and highlights.
Yeah, running is, I mean, as I said, that cycling is easy. Running is a little bit more complex, as you also have the same principles when it comes to physiology. So it's also about anaerobic, aerobic, that one lower, the other one higher. Perfect. But then it comes to the transfer of your physiology onto the street and the question about how efficient or economic you can do that. And running economy, so just to describe it out of the lab, is something where we measure running economy with the question of how many oxygen uptake you need for a certain velocity. And the less oxygen uptake you need, the better it is. When you want to calculate running economy, you always have to take into account that you have to put the resting metabolic rates off. So you for sure have a resting rate of oxygen uptake like we have by now while doing a podcast. And you have to get rid of that in the calculation because it makes a bigger impact on lower velocities, as the amount of oxygen uptake is not that high as it would be as in, for example, like threshold intensity. And then you have to take into account the sort of metabolism you are in while running that intensity. Threshold, for example, threshold running would mean more or less like 100% carbohydrate energy metabolism, whereas pretty low intensities also means a lot of fat metabolism in that running. So therefore, fat metabolism means more oxygen uptake you need for that one, which could slightly mean that your running economy is worse at low intensities. Therefore, you have to get rid of the metabolism ways in your calculation of running economy. And then statement at that moment, I would say that running economy is the most important parameter in professional triathlon. Because I would say that if you take the world-class athletes and we take the, let's say, Kona top 10, top 20, whatever, then I'm pretty sure that you won't find big differences between the VLA max values of all the athletes. And I'm pretty sure you won't find too much differences in the VO2 max values. But I'm pretty sure you'll find big differences in running economy. And in my opinion, that makes, let's say, like, not too pathetic, but the difference between winning and losing, more or less. But I think running economy is a big difference between all these, even in professional athletes. And you have to have running economies in mind, and you have to coach that, as that is way more important than just doing a lot of volume or whatever. So take into account, what do you think, how many kilometers in average Patrick runs for a 236.46 marathon in Tulsa?
I think I heard that he very rarely went longer than, was it an hour 45 for his long runs or something?
I think the longest run was like 1.5 hours, and you would never ever do a run longer than 2 hours when I coach you. So that's the longest one I would ever do. And that fact is interesting. And the other fact, which is, in my opinion, even more interesting, is the amount of running kilometers per week, let's say, in average. For sure, you have weeks where you are running slightly over average, and then you have weeks where you have more or less like resting. But if you take the average for the last half year, then I would say, so I didn't analyze it for their podcast by now, but I would say it's about like 50 to maximum 60 Ks per week. So really maximum. So, and I would say that if you ask the average pro triathlete, so if you take an average over top 20 Kona, then I would be pretty sure that the average is way higher than 60 Ks per week. But running for sure comes from running. Kilometers count, but quality is still something, especially when it comes to running economy, which is very, very important and makes the difference when it comes to whatever threshold or marathon running or whatever. So therefore, that parameter should be something. If you are doing a performance diagnostics for running, you have to find out, or you have to, whatever, go to an institute which gives you your running economy well calculated with resting rates and so on, or not with resting rates, and also excluded the metabolism state and so on. Because what you want to do is to train your running economy to use less oxygen for a certain velocity, as the potential you have from lowering your running economy is way higher than you could ever have it from hiring your VO2 max, for example.
So you're saying that basically, well, if you're not running as much, you can do that running with slightly higher quality, even when it's not necessarily intense, but you're not ending up doing super slow jogs, but you're always kind of running with a similar form. Is that the principle, that you want to always have a similar form to your race pace?
Yeah, but also to have intensities where especially your, let's say, passive structure, whether it comes to ligaments and so on, gets more stiff, for example, which makes sense when it comes to running economy, to have a certain stiffness for your foot and so on, and your knee and your hip and so on. Then what is very important for running economy is not what you have in your legs or how stiff your ligaments are, but also about your upper body. So what I'm pretty sure is pretty different from Patrick's training, for example, is that he had a lot of input concerning athletic training. So what I would describe as like strength training with like a functional strength training, where it comes to whatever, your own body weight, kettlebells, elastic bands and so on and so on, especially in winter preparation where we put a lot of effort into all that stuff of building up a stable upper body, as that one helps you to have a very good running economy in the end. And therefore, the question about running economy, so if I should give like three tips how to make your running economy better, I could not answer that, to be honest, because you do not really know what really works. I mean, if you want to hire your VO2 max, yeah, I mean, do a certain amount of volume or put some intensities in and then it works. But if it comes to running economy, it can be like, for sure, a certain volume of training makes sense. Then different intensities definitely make sense, as the impact in a threshold interval is higher than with a low intensity run. But then you could also have like plyometrics in training. So if you want to have higher impact, which you cannot afford due to running, then you maybe can add plyometrics in your training and get whatever, a place where you can do some jumping movements to have the plyometric process you have in running with a higher impact due to the jumping part. But it's also about like upper body training. Then it's also about like still being mobile in all, especially for example in your hip. I mean, hip mobility is something which is pretty important when it comes to running economy. And therefore, you have a certain amount of inputs you could have for running economy training. And to be honest, I'm not sure which was the key fact which led him to a fast marathon. So I don't know. It was a summary of all of that. I would do it for the next training period slightly in the same way. And then if you keep the kilometers on a continuous level, and this is something which is very important in my opinion, then that could work out pretty well. But the continuous level is important, because if you talk to triathletes and you ask them about the running kilometers they run per week, they always tell you about the high amounts of running kilometers. And then you hear numbers like 80, 90, 100 kilometers, and maybe the, without being how do you call it? So I don't want to say bad words, but if you take the old school athletes, let's say, without any negative wording in it, and if you would ask athletes like Andreas Rehlert, for example, famous German athlete, be sure that he would never ever call it a training week if the running kilometers are lower than 100Ks, for example, which is something which was a proper training method for sure some years ago. And I would say that you definitely have athletes where you need these 100Ks per week to have good performance outputs. But if that is not necessary and you can have a summary of different inputs in training to have a perfect running economy and therefore a good marathon, then for sure I would definitely more likely take the 60 or 50Ks per week than the 100Ks per week. As and then again, we talk about stress management and so on. 50Ks, 60Ks, no problem at all. I mean, these are like maximum four runs per week, and then you have the 60Ks. So not a problem at all. And that's pretty great when it comes to the whole stress management. So after the tools of preparation, I'm pretty sure that Patrick at the moment is pretty well recovered already, and that he did not have to have a lot of effort into the preparation for these, for that Ironman, but that he can handle that definitely twice a year to put that input into training for a training block for an Ironman for sure.
Absolutely fascinating. And with those, let's say, four runs per week, what would the structure be? Would you have a couple of more intense runs, and or yeah, can you describe that a little bit for just an example?
So the normal, let's say, low intensity run at about like 60-70% of your threshold, maximum once a week, I would say. So that's what happens by now.
Yep.
Because I think if you have a look on my training plans, you'll the workouts you have where there's not real program into it, so where it's just an A1 endurance run at 65% of your thresholds, are pretty raw. So that doesn't happen pretty often. And therefore, you'll more or less always have different intensities at to stay at the percentage with 65 for sure, warm up and so on, 65%, but then also maybe like 80% of threshold for like, let's say 3 times 5 minutes, 3 times 10 minutes. Maybe when it comes to when you are slightly near the race, then you do it with different intensities, which is like race pace, 10% up race pace, 10% lower than race pace, and you do that like 3 times 15 minutes or whatever. But when it comes to just physiological training in the months before the race, then I would say that intensity training or threshold intensities in training, let's say, is something which I would add once a week, more or less, maybe like twice a week, but you can also combine that. I mean, I think it's not necessary to divide the workouts into intensity, then the other one high intensity, then the other one low intensity. You can also have a run about an hour where you add like 2-3 times 800 meters threshold training and then have the rest easy. Is that really an intensive run? I would say, yeah, more or less. I mean, it's good to run 800 meters pretty fast for running economy, to getting out of the comfort zone and so on. Fine. Also, hiring your VO2 max makes sense, but still not that intensive, as you have to take it really into account when it comes to stress management. So it's just a normal training workout. And therefore, I think there are a lot of workouts which are somewhere, let's say, in between. So not easy, but also not high intensive, and therefore somewhere in that area. And then it depends on which phases we are in training. So let's take Boris, for example, as an athlete who has not the running performance capability like Patrick, for example. He needs more kilometers. He's doing more track sessions as he needs more intervals to getting running economy lower. For Patrick to run a half marathon in an hour and 10 or 11 minutes like Gran Canaria or Poland last year, for example, I think we did like, let's say, 5 to 10 sessions, which I would really say that these sessions were intensive or high intensive on the way to that competition. And not in the last 2 weeks, but in the last like 2-3 months. So maximum once a week, if you would say it in average. But then it's more like we have a 3-week training camp and we do it like 4 or 5 times. Go on the track, have like 800 meter intervals, but also like 400 meter intervals, for example. Something like that. So it always depends on the situation where you are at, and it always depends on the athlete, whether he needs it more often, or on the other hand, he shouldn't have it too often, because otherwise, I mean, you don't want to have him with too much stress in training if he does not need it to run fast. So I can't tell you if it's possible for him to run a marathon in 2 hours, let's say like 35 minutes low. Because I'm not sure. By now, and that what was really my main goal in Tulsa was to have some kind of proof of concept. And if that training, which I wrote down for 1.5 years, to run fast, and that worked out, but to be honest, I cannot tell you if it's possible to run a marathon in 2:35 or 2:34. I mean, we have to figure that out. For sure, there's a lot of potential in training when it comes to running volume and so on and so on, but I'm not sure. And therefore, that's what you have to do as a coach. Try to prove your own concept, make the experience if that one works, and then on race day, just hope that it works. So, and do your very best to support him in the race.
Yeah. And one final question, follow-up question on the run is, so we bring it back to economy. Would you recommend that people, even amateur triathletes, should go to a lab and with a good measurement and good calculations of economy and test their economy? Is that beneficial to actually know the actual numbers, or is it more about knowing the principles that we talked about now, the different things you can do that potentially improve economy?
So I'm a pretty bad businessman by now, because our institute earns money with performance diagnostics and coachings. But to be honest, if you are more or less a rookie, for example, or if you did your first Olympic distance last year and this year you want to, whatever, make it faster, you picked out your first mid distance you want to do or whatever, and you want to improve your running performance, then I'm 100% sure that the balance between input in training and then adapting and recovery, if that is in balance and you have a continuous amount of running kilometers, it works at first pretty well. And you don't have to do a performance diagnostics, especially if you are still able to hire the running kilometers, for example, per week. So if you are fine as a rookie running, like, let's say 10, 15, maybe maximum 20 Ks per week, and if you hire that to 25, 30, continuously, easy, still enough time to recover and so on, and that works pretty well without any bad habits, without any injuries, without feeling bad and so on, then it makes totally sense just to hire the kilometers. And you can do that until you achieve a point where you realize that you do not really have the chance to hire the kilometers anymore. Because I would say as an age group athlete, like 40, 50 Ks per week is really a high amount of training kilometers for running. And then you have to bring some quality in. And the quality is something which where a performance diagnostics can help you. The quality is something where, in my opinion, if you want to have a high quality in training, then you have to have a coach, to be honest, because there has to be someone having in mind if you really are recovered well, if you really run continuously, or if you just think that you run continuously. And running continuously means average kilometers, I'm talking about per month overall, not like in the 2 weeks where you are running while you're resting the other 2 weeks because the running kilometers were too hard and you had to recover more due to whatever issues you had, for example. And therefore, I would say on the first hand, it's easy to hire the kilometers, maybe hire the training hours and so on. And if you and you definitely will improve in your performance capability and so on. And at some point, you'll reach the, yeah, let's say the point where you realize that training on your own is fine to stay on the same level. And you have to put these, let's say, 12 hours overall or like 50 running kilometers into training to stay on that level. And if you achieve that point, then that's a great point where you should think out of the box, out of your personal box, let's say, and where you should think of whether it makes sense to do a performance diagnostic, whether it makes sense to work with a coach and so on. And but not at first hand. So not really necessary. Just try, to be honest, to write down the kilometers, go from 20 to 25 to 30, and the next block after a resting period to 25, 30, 35, and then see how it goes. And the continuous level of running kilometers will definitely help to improve. And it's that simple at on the first hand.
All right. Well, I have a lot more questions that I would like to ask, but we're running quite long already. So maybe we'll save that for perhaps another discussion later on.
However you want. I'm totally fine.
Yeah. So let's go into the rapid fire questions now. So take just one sentence to answer these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
Well, that's a... I could name so many books. It has to be scientific. I'm not into practical stuff. And when it comes to scientific things, most important book I had while studying sports science was Louise Berg, a book about nutrition science in endurance sports. I'm not sure about the right title, but if you Google Louise Berg, Professor Dr. Louise Berg, to say it correct, a book about nutrition in exercise, best book overall. And if you want to learn about macronutrients, micronutrients, caffeine, and so on, then that's the literature I would highly recommend.
Yeah, and just a note for the listeners, that Louise Burke is a past guest on the podcast, so you can find her episode.
I didn't know that, so that's great. I have to hear that session. Perfect.
Yeah, I also recommend her husband John Hawley has been on.
Same procedure
a
for
times.
Sure. Yeah, for sure.
Next
Absolutely
one,
idols.
What's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
For my own or for my athletes?
It's up to you to interpret it as however you want.
For my own, my road bike. I do not really have time to, let's say, train. But if I have some free time, like after Tulsa, and now we have like 2-3 weeks going easy, it's still great to get out, have the road bike. Also have the power meter. I cannot get rid of that one, even if it's not really fun to look on it if I see the power data on my own, to be honest. But it's still fun to ride outside my bike without any training plans, just to have fun and go from A to B and have like some kilometers, good weather. And therefore, I would say road bike is my tool number one.
Great. And finally, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
To do whatever you want and to have fun. So it's only about sports was my hobby when I was a child. Now I can do it as a whatever professional coach, or I don't know, just as my profession. And to have fun in your job, and I don't want to call it a job because it's still it's the fun part in life. And if you have fun, then it's the best thing you can have in life. I could never ever imagine doing a job which wouldn't bring me fun. So no matter about how many money you could earn or whatever, it's just about the fun part.
Yeah. Well, Björn, I've had a lot of fun in this interview. I've learned a lot. This has been really great. So really, thank you for all the information you shared. Where can listeners find you, your coaching business, website, social media, and so on?
It's on highsize.de, which is spelled like HEPSILON C EPSILON S. So highsize is our wording for that. Plus DE. We also have a podcast, but it's just for German speaking. Sorry for that one, which is the Junk Miles podcast, which you can find on Spotify and so on. But if you go on highsize.de, then you can definitely find some information about coaching and performance diagnostics, bike fittings, and so on.
Great. And I'll link to that in the show notes for the episode.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Björn. It was great to talk to you. Hope to catch up with you soon.
Perfect. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, where we'll link to Björn's personal Instagram and Twitter profiles, as well as his coaching business website and Instagram. On Thursday, we have another TTS Thursday episode coming out. And then next Monday, I interview Dr. Richard Blagrow, who is an expert in both academic and field settings in strength and conditioning for endurance runners in particular, middle and long distance runners. But we talk about it from a triathlon and general endurance sports perspective in that interview. So stay tuned for that. Richard is a wealth of knowledge, and I love to have he has such a wealth of knowledge, both from the theoretical and academic side, but also from the practical side by being a strength and conditioning coach of elite runners and runners at the highest level, but also regular age group athletes. If you are interested in going faster in your next triathlon race, do consider getting a coach or a training plan. You can check out our offerings on scientifictriathlon.com. We are very happy to help you out if you think that we can help you achieve your triathlon goals, whatever they may be. And finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and get a free online sweat test to get a personalized hydration strategy for your next race, and get 15% off your order with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. And get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.